Who would ever think that something like the communion practice of the Roman Catholic Church would be making national headlines? Last week the story started and it kind of gained a little ground. It appeared in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch most recently. This little girl in New Jersey who was, well, she was given communion, but she was given communion in a way because of a physical condition that she has. She was given communion in a way that was later declared to be invalid. It was her first communion. She's Roman Catholic. She suffers from a condition in which her body cannot tolerate wheat gluten. And if she takes it, it's damaging to her digestive system. So she was given the Lord's Supper in a Roman Catholic church, her first communion, not with a wafer of wheat bread, but with a wafer of rice bread. Later, the diocese there in New Jersey said that was an invalid communion, which, put in layman's terms, means it never happened. Now, her mother's a little upset about that. We're going to be talking with Helen Hull Hitchcock about this story in the first 15 minutes of Issues, Etc. I'd like your reaction to this story as well for the remainder of this hour. In about 15 minutes, we'll have open lines for your questions and your comments. I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues, Etc. Our call-in number, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. At about 3:45, near the end of this hour, Chris Dickey joins us. We'll talk about a Newsweek story. It's actually the cover story of Newsweek magazine, The Race to Unearth the Bible. We'll talk about the pillaging, the sale, even on eBay, of religious artifacts that are being uncovered in Iraq. Now, Iraq was off limits to much archaeological exploration for obvious reasons for the last 30 years. It is no longer off limits, but what's becoming of the priceless religious artifacts found in Iraq? A lot of these places, we're talking about the prehistory. We're talking about perhaps locations for Garden of Eden, Ur of the Chaldees, Abraham's history. Where are these things going? We'll talk about that at the end of this first hour of Issues, Etc. In the second hour, we're going to spend some time talking with Pastor Joel Baisley for the first half hour about Promise Keepers. They were just in town. The billboards, I think, have come down. They were holding a revolution for the man's spirit or something like that. All I know was, when I turned on the news Friday night, all they could talk about was the traffic jam. I think they had a conglomeration of what was it? Something happened in the Keel. That might have been the Promise Keepers. The cards were playing. It was unbelievable. And that's all they talked about for the first 20 minutes of the news. So all those Promise Keepers jamming up our roads. We'll be talking about the Promise Keepers in the second hour of the program. Then also Dr. Andrew Steinman will start at 4:30, an hour-long conversation with him, the latest in our series on Christian prayer. We'll be talking about the Lord's Prayer and true prayer. Dr. Andrew Steinman is the author of our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for August, Is God Listening? Then in the last half hour of the program, Dr. Bob Weiss joins us from Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. We'll talk about the story in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Sunday St. Louis Post-Dispatch. It covers pages and pages about embryonic stem cell research. We'll talk with him in particular about an argument made there by an ethicist that basically says Christians are against this because they have misunderstood a key Bible passage from the book of Exodus. He says if you understand it rightly, you shouldn't have any problem with embryonic stem cell research or with early abortion, for that matter. That's the lineup for today on Issues, Etc. Our call-in numbers, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. For the first few minutes, Helen Hull Hitchcock is our guest. She's a regular guest, founding director of an Orthodox Catholic women's organization called Women for Faith and Family. She joins us to talk about the story in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and nationwide about a New Jersey girl whose first communion was invalidated because the wafer she received in the Lord's Supper contained no wheat. Helen, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Give us the basic rundown on the story of this New Jersey girl and what the diocese there in New Jersey decided about her first communion.
Yeah, first, I think it's probably the reason why this is not a new issue, and the Holy See actually gave permission for low-gluten hosts to be used back in 1994. And there was a case a couple of years ago in the Boston area that surfaced. I think one reason why we're seeing this in, you know, being nationally, even internationally, reported is that there's a lot of fascination right now about the Catholic Church and the rules concerning communion. And as you know, this has become kind of a political issue this year in the United States. But the proximal issue about the celiac disease, I think there's several things that we've seen about that. Now, let's just summarize the news stories that we've seen. A few months ago, a Trenton priest administered a rice wafer to an 8-year-old girl who has celiac disease for her first communion. Now, the celiac disease is a disease of the intestines that wheat, gluten, and there are other grains as well besides wheat, causes inflammation of the lower bowel so that the small intestines, so that food can't be absorbed properly. And some of them have pain and nausea. Some have no symptoms that are visible. And there also seems to be a wide variation in the degree of gluten sensitivity, from patient to patient. So the issue is not a new one. I think what's new is that people are looking at the Catholic Church's rules with communion, and the impression conveyed by most of the news reports we've seen and comments on those news reports seem to be that the Catholic Church is really insensitive and arbitrary and rule-bound, and that this is unfair. There are other issues. There are alternatives. The rules probably need to be clarified, but that's kind of what the background to this is.
Would you go so far to say, Helen, that if it were not for the other stories swirling around the Roman Catholic Church's communion practice, in particular, the action on the part of some courageous bishops in the United States saying, look, Roman Catholic lawmakers who are pro-choice should be barred from communion until they repent. Were it not for those stories, do you think this story of the 8-year-old girl in Trenton or thereabouts would have made the papers so broadly?
Probably not, but this has been an issue in some other places, actually not in the U.S. so much, but some years ago, the church in Ireland and in Australia and some other countries had, on their own authority, just decided to stop using the wheat wafer for people who had celiac disease, and they made communion wafers out of some other grain, usually rice or cornstarch or something. And what the issue is that this is not new teaching either. In canon law, which the 1983 Code of Canon Law in the Catholic Church says that the Eucharistic sacrifice must be celebrated with bread and wine, and that the bread must be made of wheat alone, and that the wine must be wine of the grape and not corrupt. The reason why this became an issue is partly because of the fairly recent discovery of this celiac disease, which shows a gluten sensitivity. And wheat, of course, contains gluten. We've looked into this issue because there are some people who would say that the church should suspend their rules out of sensitivity for people who have this disease. It's not a super rare disease, but it's not very common either. But as I mentioned earlier, back in 1994 when this issue came up, the Holy See did issue rules saying that you have to use wheat, but you can use a low-gluten wheat, and there are also other alternatives. In the Catholic Church, a person can receive, they could receive under the form of wine alone, or they could receive a tiny fragment of the Eucharistic species, and that would not, that would be a valid communion.
So sometimes the
alternatives don't seem to be employed, and it seems like sometimes it's magnifying a problem that doesn't really exist in the church with regard to these communion rules.
So there are alternatives, either, as you say, the low gluten, which may still be a problem with someone who's got celiac sprue.
It could be.
Or they could receive communion in one kind, that is, receiving only the chalice and not the host.
That's correct. We've even seen in some of the news stories and comments how terrible it would be to give a child wine. But this is another thing that needs to be emphasized. I think other churches may hold something similar, although because Catholic teaching about the nature of the Eucharist is distinctive, a lot of people simply don't understand it. And why can't you just substitute, you know, grape Kool-Aid or rice cakes or whatever for the because they see the symbolism. It's just a symbolic meal that represents the Lord's Supper, and that it doesn't have any other dimension really than a commemoration. The Catholic Church's teaching about the Eucharist is much stronger than that, and for that reason, since Jesus used wheat bread, unleavened wheat bread, and grape wine, that was the establishment of the Eucharist, and that's why this is, you know, key. It's what Jesus did, so that's what we do. We don't change what Jesus did. But the other teaching that I think is important, the Catholic teaching that I think is important for people to understand, is that the presence of Christ in the Eucharist is in all of it. Christ is present whole and entire in both the bread and the wine and in all parts of it. So even if there's a tiny crumb, the presence of Christ is not diminished or divided by that. If you get a larger piece of bread, they don't receive more Christ, for example. So even a tiny crumb of the bread would do, and even a drop or two of wine would be a full communion, full and valid communion, and it would not be diminished by the quantity, obviously.
Folks, we're going to open up the phone lines for your reaction to this story in about 5 minutes. Our call-in number, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. This has some affinity, Helen, and this is kind of the ongoing conversation that takes place not only in the Roman Catholic Church, but in other sacrament-observing churches regarding giving wine to recovering alcoholics in the Lord's Supper,
mm-hmm.
doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And that was actually covered in the same document in 1994 that I mentioned earlier as well.
So the mother here, Elizabeth Polly Waldman, mother of the 8-year-old girl whose communion was invalidated, has said a number of things in the press. Wants to appeal to the Vatican. Wants to appeal to the Holy See, asking that the rules be changed. She says at one point, these are just church rules. It's not God's will. It can be easily adjusted to meet the needs of people while staying true to the traditions of our faith. Your reaction to that comment?
Well, it would be really good if maybe her priest or her bishop sat down with her and explained to her about the nature of church doctrine, and that church teachings are not just something that can be changed at one's whim, and that we all have, you know, certain things about the church's rules that we may not like, and Catholic doctrine or Christian teaching that we find annoying or would like to have changed to suit our circumstances. But that simply, she probably just does not really understand that the reason, and because she doesn't understand the reason for it, she thinks that it should be able to be changed. It might be good if she talked to a priest or her bishop about this.
Finally, Helen, it seems as though this is the thread running through both of the big stories, this one that will probably not be so big, but also the big story about the Roman Catholic bishops denying communion to unrepentant pro-choice Roman Catholic lawmakers. People, at least it seems so much in America, Roman Catholics want to define Catholic in their own terms. They want to say, I'm a Catholic by my own definition. If I'm a Roman Catholic lawmaker, I say, well, that means, I'm Catholic, but I don't feel any need to abide by what the church teaches regarding life, or in the case of simple misunderstanding of this mother and her child.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. And this is not just affect the Catholic Church, of course, but especially recently, there's been a lot of attention on the Catholic Church and her teachings. And why can't we just change it if we don't like it? on various issues, the marriage, communion, responsibility for receiving communion, worthily receiving communion. And in this case, what seems like sort of an arcane matter that would only affect a few people and a few theologians would be interested in it, about the nature of the Eucharist and the material that constitutes a valid Eucharist. That seems like a really arcane thing. It's kind of hard to escape the idea that it's the church is under fire right now and is undergoing a lot of criticism, and it's just any old stick to beat the dog. But there are real issues here, and if you're Catholic, it's up to you pretty much to find out what the church really teaches about it and understand why. That's one of the things that underlies all of the attention, I think, that we've been seeing to Catholic communion rules.
Helen Holt Hitchcock is founding director of an Orthodox Catholic women's organization called Women for Faith and Family. Helen, thank you again for being our guest.
Thank you.
The website for Women for Faith and Family is wf-f.org. That's wf-f.org. Your reaction to this story, I remember hearing about it last week. They were talking about it here in the St. Louis media. I'd like your thoughts on this story of the New Jersey girl whose First Communion was invalidated because the wafer she received in the Lord's Supper contained no wheat. She got a rice wafer. She has celiac sprue, which is a condition that makes her sensitive to wheat gluten. Now, wheat bread is the standard for the Lord's Supper. What do you think about this? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's Monday, August the 23rd. We are coming to you live today. In about 20 minutes, we'll be talking about the pillage of religious artifacts in the newly opened region of Iraq. People are running out there. They're ready to find artifacts. What's becoming of them? Are they being given to archaeologists to study or sent to museums for further research? No, they're being sold for money on the open market. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Is it merely a tempest in the teapot, or does it really make any difference? You know, I think it's been a common practice among Christian denominations and non-denominations who have a low view of the Lord's Supper to kind of play fast and loose with what the Lord's Supper is. You know, when they want to be authentic, then they'll use bread and, for the most part, the non-denominational and the low view of the sacrament denominations will use something like grape juice. They got a hang up about wine. Well, but if it's, say, a youth gathering or a youth retreat, or they're feeling a little frisky that Sunday, they might just use something else. The Mormons, what do they use? Water and bread? I think they don't use wine. I think they use water and bread. Some would insist upon unleavened bread. Others say, no, it's just bread. Bread is bread. I remember going to the hospital to give the Lord's Supper to a parishioner. This was 10 years ago. When I got there, much to my chagrin, I realized that while I had brought the wine, I had not brought the bread. I opened up the little container that usually had the communion wafers in it, and it was just completely empty. There wasn't even a crumb there, which would have sufficed, as Helen pointed out. I had to send a nurse down to the cafeteria, bring me up some bread. Well, they don't have unleavened bread in the cafeteria. They have white bread, and that had to do in that particular case. What do you think about this story of the New Jersey girl whose First Communion was invalidated because it was the wrong kind of wafer? 505-7850. 1-800-730-2727. Up first, Keith calling from his car. Keith, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Pat. How are you today?
Doing well.
Yeah, the only thing that has occurred to me concerning this was that as Lutherans, we should be thankful that this girl is not able to receive communion, giving our view of the Roman Catholic practice of communion.
Explain what you mean there, Keith, if you would.
Well, I think with Luther, most Lutherans would view the Roman Catholic practice as an abomination, and it would be beneficial for this girl not to be participate in that type of practice.
Well, let me see if I can clarify that, Keith. I don't think we would consider it an abomination. We would consider it, at worst, at worst, a misunderstanding and therefore wrong teaching about the Lord's Supper. But in more cases than not, if you're talking about the teaching of the sacrifice of the Mass, or the representation of the sacrifice of the Mass, then of course that is an element of their teaching that we would have to reject completely. That there is any kind of unbloody sacrifice, and I know that Catholics will say we don't teach an unbloody sacrifice, but look in your catechism, it says you teach an unbloody sacrifice. That may not be what your priest taught you, that may not be what you were taught, but it is what your church teaches, okay? But with regard to the presence of Christ's body and blood there in the Lord's Supper, while we will differ with them adamantly on the how, because they want to answer the question how, and Lutherans refuse to answer the question how. We say it's present according to his word. We don't have to go into any fancy explanations of transubstantiation or consubstantiation. I wouldn't go so far as to call it an abomination. Now, she is receiving it, being told that this is some good work she's doing that pleases God. Well, then they have turned the Lord's Supper into something that, as Paul would say to the Corinthians, you're no longer practicing the Lord's Supper, you're doing your own supper there. That's what Paul says to the Corinthians. But you know what? That's precisely what Protestants who reject the presence of Christ's body and blood in the Lord's Supper do every Sunday, if they have the Lord's Supper. They teach this is just a memorial feast by which we are doing something. God really isn't doing anything here. We're doing something. We're just remembering. Just, you know, like making a toast to a deceased loved one. No. Scripture is very clear. The Roman Catholics are right on this, along with the Lutherans and others, say certain Episcopalians. God really is doing something in the Lord's Supper. Now, the question in the New Jersey story is, so just for clarity, if it is an abomination for the Roman Catholics to teach that they're doing something in the Lord's Supper, which is somehow meriting further grace from God, it is equally an abomination for Protestants who reject the biblical view of the Lord's Supper to practice it and say, you know, just remembering what God did here. Yeah, this might help me because I kind of vaguely remember what Jesus did, but God isn't doing anything here. They've taken out of God's hands and put it into their own hands. It's an equal abomination. But the question here is, what did Christ institute as the Lord's Supper? You can have unleavened bread. You can have a goblet of wine. If you don't teach that it is what Christ says it is, you don't have the Lord's Supper. You're trampling upon the body and blood of Christ, regardless of what your denomination is. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Betty, stay on the line. When we come back from this break, we'll take your phone call. It's open lines here for about another 10 minutes. Then we're going to be talking with the co-author of this week's Newsweek cover story, The Race to Unearth the Bible. Chris Dickey will join us. He's Middle East Regional Editor for Newsweek magazine about the pillaging of religious artifacts in Iraq. That's coming up after the break and after your phone calls. Open lines when we come back, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. What do you think about this New Jersey girl having her first communion invalidated because of the use of a rice wafer?
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
So many books on Christian prayer emphasize the Christian rather than prayer. They talk about praying the right prayer, the right way, with the right attitude. All the emphasis is on you. Is this what Christian prayer is really all about? How can you know that God is hearing and answering your prayers even when God seems silent and no answers seem to come? Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for August is called Is God Listening? You can order Is God Listening by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, or browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. Look under the What's New section for the Issues Etc. book of the month for August, Is God Listening by Dr. Andrew Steinman, 1-800-325-3040, or issuesetc.org.
The Summer Olympics are winding down in Athens, Greece, so this Global Minute turns your attention to the Middle Eastern country of Qatar. They're planning to host the Asian Games in 2006. Construction workers are building a new stadium in Qatar that will be the center of a major sporting event. Pray that people in this oil-rich kingdom will hear about Jesus Christ. The Global Prayer Digest magazine reports that Christianity was illegal in Qatar until a few years ago, when a group of Christian foreign workers petitioned to establish the first legal church inside the country. Today, a strict anti-conversion law makes it illegal for Christians to share their beliefs with Muslims. Pray Christians will boldly proclaim the gospel anyway, and that there will be a great spiritual awakening in Qatar. Ready to climb out of your comfort zone? Explore the website missionvisionnetwork.org. That's missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. She slips off every morning to do it. Diane and I usually sit together in the morning to read the papers over coffee, but sooner or later she slips away to indulge her habit. In the evening, she sneaks off to do it again. At first, a few hits made her feel good, but the habit is insatiable. A few hits are no longer enough. She wants more and more and more every day. My wife is a blogger. A blog is an online diary of sorts where the blogger comments on whatever. When Diane wrote about the Iraqi soccer team, all sorts of people, Iraqis included, visited her blog. And when she commented about sportscaster Bob Costas's political remarks, she got more hits. Blogs are becoming big-time media. Sinful human nature likes to complain, and a constantly heard complaint is the bias of traditional media outlets. The Spirit of Christ offers future heavenly blessings, but also motivates us to contribute here and now to society, not complain. Are most of us sitting in our easy chairs complaining about media? Or moving our mouse to get informed? Diane goes off to her blog, Res Publica, and comes back to tell me about the hits. I'm learning things not on TV. What a great time to be an involved citizen.
You're at home relaxing or maybe listening to AM 850 KFUO at work. You could be driving around the St. Louis area. But did you know that AM 850 KFUO is a worldwide ministry via the internet? Your support is needed to continue spreading the good news of Jesus Christ to all nations. We've made it easy for you to donate online. Go to KFUO.org, click the support tab at the left, fill out the secure form, hit submit. It's that easy to support your favorite ministry, AM 850 KFUO. And thank you for your support.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Let's go straight to the phones. Don is calling from her car. Don, welcome to Issues Etc.
Good. My only question or comment maybe is that when I was in confirmation class so many years ago, our pastor made it clear that a sacrament was, you know, means of grace, something physical along with the Word of God. And we were always told that even for baptism, you didn't have to have water. You could baptize with sand because it was God's Word attached to that. And I guess I'm wondering if there's the same parallel here as far as water and or wine and bread is concerned.
Don, was this a Lutheran church you were taught in?
It was.
Really? Interesting.
Yes.
Sand. Never heard that one before. Well, I mean, for that matter, we could use dog poop. I mean, we could use anything we wanted to use if it doesn't matter. No, the question is, what did Christ institute? In an emergency, just to straighten it out for you, Don, your pastor was wrong. We wouldn't use sand. It wouldn't be a baptism. It wouldn't be a washing. It wouldn't be what Christ instituted. Now, the amount of water is irrelevant, and the means by which the water is applied is irrelevant if it's an emergency. But in the best of all possible worlds, we will apply it as close to Christ's institution as we can find, and we would not undo the water, because then we would be deviating from what Christ instituted. It'd be the same thing if someone says, you know, we're going to do the Lord's Supper, and we can use whatever we want because the important thing is the Word. Yes, the important thing is the Word, but Christ in his institution attached that Word to certain things, to bread, to wine, to water. And so we do not disregard two things. We don't disregard Christ's institution either in what he says in the Word or in what he attaches that Word to. We do not disregard his institution because he's the one who gave it to us. And number two, we do not allow any kind of an emergency situation to become the norm or to make the rule for the rest of how we practice something. Well, sure, I could use, I could get a specially designed nozzle that would spray one molecule of water. I could do that. Then I wouldn't waste any water, you know. But why would you do that? What are you trying to test the limits of how much you can play fast and loose with this? No. Christ's institution is simple. It is straightforward. We simply follow it to the best of our ability. Betty's calling from Kirkwood, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I had never heard sand before. I guess sand. Betty, welcome to Issues Etc.
Yeah, hi, Todd. How are you?
Very well.
My question is not about the proper administration of the sacrament in anybody else's church, as other people have been calling in. Whatever church wants to give the sacrament, or if they're even calling it that, in whatever way they want to do it, that's up to them. That's not for me to say. My question is, being a Catholic and loving the sacrament of the Eucharist, did that priest not understand the proper administration? Did the deacon get... What's that part of the story? That's the part that I'm interested
well,
in. And maybe Helen would need to be consulted on that.
Well, did you see the story in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch?
I did not.
It was in Friday's edition of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch in the Nation section. And what happened was the priest used a rice wafer in this girl's first communion. Now, whether he was aware of the fact that this was contrary to the teaching of the church, I'm not clear. What Helen did say was, look, the mother in this case seems to be unaware of what the church teaches and the alternatives that were present for her daughter. They did not need to, I guess Helen's point was they didn't need to use a rice wafer in the first place because she could have received the sacrament in one kind. Or there is a low gluten substitute, which may have, just may have been.
Or she could have received the precious blood.
Right. So we might be dealing with either a lack of knowledge on the part of the priest or just a lack of diligence on the part of the priest.
Yeah, that would be the part of the story that I would be interested in knowing more details about. But thanks for bringing out how very important the Lord's body and blood is to us as Christians.
Betty, thank you. Sandra is calling from Peavely. Sandra, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hello. All right. Well, first of all, when you're talking sacrament-wise and to the caller before, this other lady, I'm Catholic, and I was taught that, true, you needed water for baptism. However, we were also taught that you could be baptized by blood, say, if a person was in an accident and there was some blood involved, I mean, in danger of death. Is this the feeling also of Lutherans?
I'd never heard that, Sandra. Thank you for the call. I have never heard that. Now, see, here's the thing. That's why I say Christ's institution is simple. It is straightforward. Water is abundant. And unless you're in the Sahara, you're not going to find open pools of water. But our body also, saliva is mostly water. Lots of things are mostly water, aren't they? But Christ didn't give us the baptism to administer with things that are mostly water. He didn't give these things to us so that we could test to see how far we could go and still have it be water. Well, Jell-O in your freezer or in your refrigerator contains some water. I mean, it does. You would hardly call Jell-O water, but it does contain water. So I say again, Christ's institution is simple, it is straightforward, and it's not something that Christians of goodwill are going to be anxious to tamper with or test. Why? Not because there are a bunch of rules at play, but because the certain and sure thing is what Christ gave. And Christians always find their certainty and their assurance in what Christ gave, what Christ said, and what he has given. And one would ask kind of rhetorically, why would you want to do something other than what Christ has given us to do? Now, in the case of the girl with the celiac sprue, there were alternatives, valid alternatives. But I've never heard any of the issue of baptism by blood. No, I haven't. Kent is calling from his car. Kent, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thanks, Todd. I think I can shed some light on that.
Please do if you can.
It's not a literal using blood in place of water, and it is an ancient teaching, like when catechumens would spend years learning about the faith before baptism. If they then fell victim to Roman persecution and death in the arena, their blood that was shed at their death would be deemed efficacious and equivalent to water baptism, oh, which is necessary for salvation. That's what that means.
Interesting. Interesting. So really, it is a teaching that basically says while baptism, water baptism, as Christ instituted, is necessary.
Yes.
For salvation, it's not absolutely necessary. That is, the actual act of water baptism, if faith is present, is not necessary for
right,
salvation.
Right, in those extreme circumstances. And I would think that, that would hold true and continue for murdered unborn babies.
I'm not going to touch that one with an
okay.
with a 10-foot
pole. Yeah, we can talk about that another time.
Yeah, thank you. I would just to respond briefly, I would draw a distinction between those who have given their lives as martyrs for the faith and those who are senselessly and thoughtlessly murdered in the case of abortion. I don't know how I'd draw that distinction, but I think the distinction does exist. In other words, I wouldn't call all unborn babies Christian martyrs, those who are slaughtered through abortion. Our call in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. What is most interesting to me here is the fact that this is a story that has not only, it doesn't have long legs, it's got short legs, but it's got legs. And it's managed to survive a week and a half in the national press. And I think Helen was right. This story would not be on the cover of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch if it were not for the scrutiny under which the Roman Catholic Church finds itself for other policies regarding the Lord's Supper, in particular the policies of some of the courageous bishops who are saying that pro-life Roman Catholic lawmakers ought to be denied communion until they repent. I don't think this would be a story if that was not a story. And isn't it interesting how even the most people walking the streets would consider the teaching and the practice of the Roman Catholic Church regarding the Lord's Supper as something esoteric, as something obscure, as something which this simply does not occupy their everyday thinking, unless they're Roman Catholics. And here we are having national conversations about these very things. Here we are talking about it. It's fascinating. Chris Dickey joins us here for the remainder of the hour. You may have seen the cover story of Newsweek magazine, The Race to Unearth the Bible. Chris is Middle East regional editor for Newsweek magazine and co-author of that cover story. We're going to talk about the pillaging of religious artifacts in newly opened Iraq. Chris, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yeah, my pleasure.
What is the situation on the ground there in Iraq with regard to the discovery and the continuing discovery of new archaeological artifacts?
Well, there isn't much going on in terms of discovering legitimate discovery of new artifacts. Almost all the major sites, and there are 10,000 official sites and perhaps another 90,000 unofficial sites known to exist in Iraq, almost all of them have been opened up by robbers and looters now. Very few of them are being protected. So countless pieces of from pieces of pottery to more significant sculptures, plates, metalwork, all of that is just disappearing and not under any control at all.
Did it begin with the famous looting of the Baghdad museums there that took place during the invasion of Iraq?
No, actually it didn't. It began back in 1992 or so under the embargo against Saddam Hussein and against Iraq. People just didn't have any money anymore. The corruption began to spread really seriously in the government, and you started to have more and more looting. It really took off in about 1996. So it was bad before the American invasion and occupation. But then the occupation itself did not take into account what would be needed to protect these treasures. And the most obvious example of that was the treatment of the Iraqi National Museum itself, which, as we know, was looted extensively. Not quite as badly as the first report suggested, but quite badly enough. there are still well over 8,000 pieces missing, and almost 30 of those are really priceless and impossible to replace.
What kind of sites? You mentioned 10,000, but of course there are sites and then there are sites, Chris. What kind of sites are we talking about in terms of their religious significance, and what kind of artifacts are we talking about in terms of their religious significance?
Well, I think what we have to look at is the world in which the Old Testament took place. This is really what we're talking about. Abraham, of course, came from Ur. That is one of the sites, the site of Ur itself. The Assyrians came out of Nineveh. That is another site. And then, of course, there's Babylon, which figures both literally and figuratively all the way from the early books of the Old Testament to the book of Revelations. So, in fact, you're talking about that whole world in which the Bible took place. Much of what was going on in the Holy Land, which was really on the periphery of this world, was a reaction to the decadence, to the grandeur, to the excesses, to the enormity of the Mesopotamian civilization. And there is a lot of that left, unlike what's in the Holy Land, where, of course, if you're excavating and looking for things left behind by Jesus and his immediate followers, you were talking about very poor people who actually did not leave much behind.
So we're really talking about the significance is, even apart from its religious importance, civilizations themselves in this area left behind for the archaeologist an enormous amount of data from which we can
You can reconstruct the world of the era of the Bible, if you want. I mean, it isn't terribly attractive to people who have a very, very literal impression, because as one archaeologist said to me, these are the bad guys in a lot of the Bible. Nebuchadnezzar is one of the great evil figures in the Bible when he takes the Jews out of the Holy Land and takes them to Babylon. But in fact, if you read the story of the book of Daniel, if you read Kings, if you read Chronicles, if you read Genesis, you see these cities coming up again and again, because it's as if your faith were starting somewhere out in the desert of the Southwest, and you were writing about and thinking about what happened in New York or San Francisco. Those were the big cities. That was the civilization against which everything else was measured.
You mentioned the occupation force there in Iraq, and they're not taking into account this kind of situation not only has existed from 1992, but as it's continuing to emerge. Tell us more about that.
Well, I think, you know, we've seen again and again that the occupation forces were completely unprepared for what they've encountered in Iraq over the last year and a half. They were ready to defeat the army, but they were not ready to run the country, and neither were any of the people that they brought with them. As a result, you've had what has amounted to chaos in a lot of Iraq, breaking out again and again and again, and getting progressively worse. Well, the first places to suffer from this are the archaeological digs, because they don't have the kind of immediate economic significance, for instance, of the oil installations. But remember, in Baghdad, they still don't have electricity 24 hours a day. There are attacks on Americans and coalition troops more than 40 times a day. The United States is spending hundreds of billions of dollars there just to sustain the occupation as it is. Nobody's putting the resources into protecting these sites all around the country and protecting, in fact, the record of life and civilization 2,000, 3,000, more than 3,000 years ago.
Where are the artifacts that are stolen or looted or sold? Where are they most likely going to end up?
They are most likely going to end up with collectors. Some of them will find their way into museums, although museums are, of course, under a lot of pressure to be very careful. But private collectors are going to want to have these items to put them on their walls or put them in their safe deposit boxes, to cherish them, to love them, but out of all context, out of the context in which they're found. And one of the things you have to understand about archaeology is that archaeologists are like crime scene investigators, if you will. It's not just the clue they need to have their hands on. They need to know where the clue was found, how it was found, when it was placed there. They need to know all about the context and the surround of the clue or the artifact, if you will, in order to get the kind of information that allows them to really understand and explore what was happening thousands of years ago. And that is what is really being destroyed. I mean, we are losing thousands and thousands and thousands of artifacts into the black market. That's true. But much worse than the artifacts, we're losing the entire context in which each of those things was found.
And that can't be restored. It's not like, give me back the statue, we go back to where the guy dug it up.
There is no restoring that. This is completely irreplaceable. You cannot fix this when it's broken, and it is being broken worse every day.
So in other words, the archaeologist sits there helpless to do anything, but watches potential founts of knowledge and of history being destroyed irreparably.
Well, they can't, and they can't even watch it because most of these places are too dangerous to get to now. There are many archaeologists who are involved with digs, big digs, not so far, maybe 50 or 100 miles from Baghdad, that they just can't visit anymore because it's become untenable. The security situation is just disastrous. Foreigners are kidnapped. Foreigners are murdered just for being foreigners. The country is in a state of continuous low-grade insurgency, and the last safe place to be is at a remote dig living in a tent with no one to defend you.
Under Saddam Hussein's quarter-century regime, how did these sites and the artifacts fare?
Well, Saddam and part of his totalitarian regime tried to protect these things and was fairly effective at it, although he did a lot of damage with bad restoration, because he saw Babylon, for instance, as a sort of a model for his own glory and totalitarianism, and he identified himself with Nebuchadnezzar specifically because Nebuchadnezzar had been responsible for the destruction of Jerusalem. So there was all that sort of weird text surrounding what Saddam did. But he was not going to allow, and did not allow until the 1990s, any kind of extensive looting of these sites. There's always some, but now it's wholesale. Now it's an industry carried out in broad daylight with nobody to stop it.
You tell the story about a man who calls himself Hassan, who's out there in broad daylight digging holes.
Broad daylight and 120-degree heat.
What puts someone out in the desert digging holes in 120-degree heat?
He's poor. He wants the money. And if you can make every artifact you get that's of any significance at all, you can make $15, $20 on the spot for digging it up. That's a lot of money in Iraq today. And for those who are the middlemen, they're making thousands of dollars on those pieces. So there's a lot of money going into it, and you can find laborers to do this kind of work fairly easily. They don't feel any particular compunction about it. Ironically, the most fundamentalist Muslims are not at all bothered by this because they see this as all idol worship and anathema and something to be taken advantage of, exploited economically, and gotten rid of. Remember, these are in some ways the same people who blew up the statues at Bamiyan in Afghanistan. And at the same time, you've got these middlemen who really are organized criminals on a par with drug traffickers. In fact, we think some of them probably are drug and arms traffickers. And it appears that a lot of the artifacts that have been taken are being storehoused in different places. We could hope that we could find some of those storehouses, and occasionally, rarely, they are found. But it looks as if they're waiting to see how the market works out, because nobody has ever put this much Mesopotamian art on the market.
And as you said before, even if a storehouse is found with a bunch of newly extracted artifacts, there's no way to get the lineage of this artifact restored again.
No, yes, you cannot. You cannot get the lineage restored again, and you can't get the specific context in which it's found. Obviously, experts can look at a given piece, a little idol, and say, this must come from this period, it must have been found, or most likely was found at this dig. They can begin to do that kind of guesswork about the artifact itself, but the artifact can't tell them anything more. Whereas if, for instance, you're at an archaeological dig and you have the ruins of a house buried under other houses, you know more or less when that house was built, when it was destroyed. You know more or less what the function of the different rooms was. If you find animal bones in one room, you think probably it was a kitchen or a refectory of some sort. And then when you find artifacts in that room, all of that tells you something about the way people were living. In Mesopotamia, in addition to that, You have a written record. You have seals that have inscriptions on them. You have clay tablets that have cuneiform writing on them, all of which gives you potentially an almost unlimited and encyclopedic vision of a world that existed 3,000 years ago. And if you can't place where those things are found exactly, what room, what level, when, how, under what circumstances, you can't begin to know what you're really looking at.
Is there any way that the Iraqi government or the coalition forces cooperating together can, at least in the foreseeable future, bring a stop to the pillaging of these artifacts in Iraq?
I think that they will start to try within the next year or two, but if they achieve calm on other fronts. But this is nobody's first priority in Iraq. There have been some monies given. The Italians are trying to send some carabinieri in to guard sites. But when you're talking about 10,000 sites, or let's say 100 sites of major importance, it's very hard to guard those 24 hours a day, and it's just impossible when you have the kind of lawless situation that prevails now. You can imagine what it's like to hire local guards, say 4 or 5, to guard a site of 100 acres or a couple of 100 acres. And when the men arrive with guns and pickup trucks in the middle of the night, are they going to stand there and shoot it out with them? In most cases, no, they're not.
Chris Dickey is Middle East Regional Editor for Newsweek magazine, co-author of the cover story in this week's Newsweek titled The Race to Unearth the Bible. Chris, thanks for being our guest on Issues, Etc.
My pleasure.
When we come back from this break, we've got a half-hour conversation with Pastor Joel Baisley. We're going to be talking about Promise Keepers. They were in town this week, promising a revolution for the man's soul or spirit, something along those lines. What, you know, some of you might have thought Promise Keepers was defunct. It is smaller than it used to be, although still popular. We're going to find out what Promise Keepers is all about when Pastor Joel Baisley joins us on the other side of the break. Then, at 4:30, we begin an hour-long conversation with Dr. Andrew Steinman, Associate Professor of Theology and Hebrew at Concordia University in River Forest, Illinois, and author of our Issues, Etc. book of the month for August, Is God Listening? We'll be talking about the Lord's Prayer and true prayer, and we'll round off today's Issues, Etc., talking with Dr. Bob Weiss, Professor of Pastoral Ministries and Life Science at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis, about the story in Sunday's St. Louis Post-Dispatch on stem cell research. If you'd like to read this article on the pillaging of religious artifacts in Iraq, go to the website for Newsweek. It's newsweek.com. Newsweek.com, the cover story, The Race to Unearth the Bible, co-authored by Chris Dickey. When we come back, the Promise Keepers, who are they, what have they been up to lately, and what took place here in St. Louis when they promised the revolution for the man's soul? Stay with us.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.